Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is A Good Story is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
Yes, and I have something very important to reveal.
Uh-oh.
After all these years.
Are you the sister I've always been looking
for? That's right, that's right. Oh, man. We are going to talk about, this is episode 165, and we're going to talk about a movie that was surprising to me, Tootsie from 1982, and it's not like I haven't seen it. I have, and I remember enjoying it back then, but rewatching it, it is a magnificent movie. It is really, really good.
And it's aged well, hasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it absolutely has. Although, you know, the 80s were... You know, I was in high school in the 80s, you know, so it was mm-hmm. cool. I mean, there was, they were definitely 80s folks, right? But the whole story, everything was, you're right. It held together great. I was surprised at how much I enjoyed it. I really did.
Yeah, it is. I'm trying to see if I can find this quote really quick. Roger Ebert said that the great thing about it is it was like a movie. It says, Tootsie is the kind of movie, and he capitalizes it, with a capital M, that they used to make in the 1940s when they weren't afraid to mix up absurdity with seriousness, social comment with farce, and a little heartfelt tenderness right in there with the laughs. This movie gets you coming and going.
Wow. Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
That's well put. It's really well put. Yeah, in my head, I admit that this one and Mrs. Doubtfire were mixed up.
Oh, so when I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, so when I started to watch it, I was like, okay, so he's divorced and blah, 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 which is what the story of Mrs. Doubtfire is.
Mm-hmm.
And then immediately I realized, oh, no, that's not the story of this at all. So
wasn't that Robin Williams?
Yeah, that was Robin Williams, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. And he, I recall, was, you know, good as Mrs. Doubtfire, but the story and stuff, it wasn't... This movie... kind of transcends that, I guess. It's not just about him being this woman, right? He dresses up as a woman in the story, but that's not, it's like in Mrs. Doubtfire, right? That was the point, right?
Yeah. And I only have the vaguest memories of Mrs. Doubtfire because mm-hmm. I loathed it so much after I saw it.
Yeah, yeah.
I really felt it was a one-trick pony, and if you didn't love seeing Robin Williams dress up as a woman, which was not something I loved, then mm-hmm. there wasn't a lot there.
Yeah.
And this movie I chose because, for one thing, I felt like we needed something a little more fun. Before we dive back
Wait
into
a
the
minute.
Serious
yeah.
Oh, no. I have Dracula coming up.
All right. Fantastic.
No, I'm in this, too.
I love it.
And Flannery O'Connor.
Yes.
My idea.
Absolutely.
So, you know, I'm not casting stones at anyone.
Yeah.
But I felt like a little levity wouldn't hurt. And I thought my memory of the movie was about the gender awareness, in a sense, not in the way you say it today, of course, but in the idea that men and women really are different and are treated differently, but in very subtle ways sometimes that everybody doesn't notice. And so I was thinking, oh, it'd be interesting to see how that looks at it versus how we think about it today. And so I was really pleased to find how much of it I didn't really remember.
Hmm.
So it was very funny to me. And also then I was really pleased to see that it still works really well because these truths in this movie are universal truths.
Hmm. Yeah.
To me.
Yeah. Good point. Yeah. I couldn't help but to think about gender during it, you know, which mm-hmm. is part of the point, you know, you're talking about social commentary, which you mentioned that Roger Ebert noticed.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, I saw that too. I wonder, you know, if that movie was made today, the points that they'd be trying to make today would be different, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, they definitely have a gay character or a transvestite, or they'd have somebody there representing instead of here. It's just left straight between men and women.
Yeah, yeah, That's right.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And well done. Like you said, you know, there's comedy and there's seriousness. It's like, I don't know, you remember MASH? Mm-hmm. You know, MASH was masterful at that. You know, there was comedy, but it was also very serious at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like this, right?
Yeah.
In the same vein.
Mm-hmm. Well, exactly. It's funny. I was just listening to this new podcast. It's the first episode, and I'm only partway through. But I like it so far, and it's, oh, God, what's it called? It's called Jaws of Life.
Jaws of Life.
Yeah, and it's by two Catholic guys, and they say something like they're rescuing sanity from the contemporary culture or something like that. Oh,
how about that? You know? Which is kind of what we try to do.
Right,
but
exactly.
But yeah, go ahead.
But they're talking about it more directly. So the first episode is about humor and mm-hmm. faith. And they were quoting G.K. Chesterton, who said people think that the opposite of humor is seriousness, or being funny is seriousness. And they go, no, the opposite is not funny.
Mm.
You can be funny and serious at the same time. And so they were going through and talking about examples in the Bible where if you're looking at it the right way, you're going, you just want to crack up.
Oh, that's
you know,
cool.
Like the thing of, you know, Jesus was in the wilderness and fasted for 40 days and then he was hungry. It's like, yeah, you know.
And he was very hungry.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So, anyway.
Yeah, that's a good point. So, Jaws of Life. We got that written down.
Yes.
That's great.
We'll put a link.
You bet. So, what is this movie about? What is this, the plot?
So, this movie is about a very serious theater actor, Michael Dorsey, who is so serious about his art that he has been out of work for a really long time. And after his agent tells him that he can't get him any work because nobody will work with him, which, oh, we're going to come back to that. he has heard about this audition for a part on a soap opera. So he goes and dresses himself up as a woman and goes and tries out and through his audacity gets the part. Hmm. And then it shows him both struggling with, you know, how does he keep straight being a man and being a woman? And how does this affect him? How does it help him see the world differently around him? While at the same time, it shows us behind the scenes struggling actors in New York. It shows us being on a soap opera and kind of plunges him into a world where he has a crush on somebody, but he can't express it because she's a woman and she only knows him as Dorothy Michaels.
Right, right.
Is that good enough?
That is good enough. You bet. You bet. So I don't think we need to worry about spoiling it because it was out from 1982, but that's the synopsis. So if you'd like to watch it before we talk more, go right ahead.
Yeah, if you haven't watched it for a while, watch it again because it's one of those movies that, you know, as we both said, you think you remember it, but you don't really remember all of it. It's a more complicated movie than you think.
Yeah. When I was watching it, you know, I remembered it, you know, as soon as the first scenes came in, I was like, oh yeah, I remember this. But the details, you know, I was pleasantly surprised numerous times. Number one surprise is that I had no memory of Bill Murray being in this movie. And he is so good. He is really just great.
That's funny. That's one of my favorite memories. Mm-hmm. And maybe because I knew that he improvised most of his lines.
No way. He just made that up.
Yeah, they were funnier than the lines that were written. So they started encouraging him to improvise. And then also he agreed to not have his name in the upfront marketing because people might think it was like Stripes or Meatballs or some of those really broad comedies he'd been in. And they were like, meatballs. You know, you're really great, but
oh, there's
this
some
isn't
memory.
That.
Meatballs.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Oscar-winning meatballs.
Yeah. Well, Stripes is not, you know, top of the line either.
Stripes and, oh, that's great stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Good.
Ghostbusters, which I can't remember exactly when that came out.
Yeah,
but
it came out. I actually looked that up. It's after. Because I was just curious what they did before and after both.
Okay, so nobody would have known him for that. They would have known him for, you know, other things.
Yeah.
So,
Army training, sir. Yeah, that one.
Yes.
One of the things Stripes and Caddyshack were both out slightly before this, yeah.
And Caddyshack especially. Yeah.
Cinderella's Story. I don't
want to see this movie. Yeah.
Yep. You're right. This is completely different than that. But he was mm-hmm. great. So he plays an out-of-work actor that lives with Michael. Right.
He's a playwright.
Michael, yeah, and he's a playwright. Isn't he an actor as well? It seemed to me that he was taking roles. And then he was writing as well.
But the reason Michael is desperate to get the soap opera role is because Bill Murray's character has written, Jeff, I guess his name is, has written a play that they want to produce, and they need $8,000 to rent the theater and all this mm-hmm. sort of thing. So that's why he takes the work.
Mm-hmm.
Because he wants to be able to act in this play, and nobody's going to finance it.
Right. And I felt, and this may be me reading into it, that the reason that he wanted to do his friend's play in the first place is because no one hires him to do anything else. He really wants to be in, he's trying out constantly, but because he has this reputation of being difficult, they shun him. Right? Mm-hmm. You were a tomato. Right. I remember that scene. You know,
oh my gosh.
He said,
yes.
Yeah, you were a tomato in a commercial for a half a day and it went over schedule because you wouldn't sit down.
Yes. Because tomatoes don't sit down.
It was
they
illogical.
Don't move. He's like, and the director or the producer, because Sidney Pollack, who played his agent, was the director of the movie.
That's right. Yeah.
And he says something about, you know, well, tomatoes don't walk. And he goes, that's my point exactly.
Oh, that was good.
But the interesting thing about this movie, and this, it may or may not be what we want to talk about, but it does intersect with real life in some very interesting ways. For one thing, Dustin Hoffman has a reputation, and certainly at that time, of being very difficult to
work. Really? See, I don't know these inside stories. So
all the way. Yeah. Well, all the way.
Because I thought Frank Sinatra was a saint until you told me he wasn't.
Oh. Oh, really? Okay. Maybe it's that 10-year age gap between us. I don't know.
I'm just joking. But I did not know that Dustin Hoffman was difficult. I thought he was.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Well, not the tomato thing, I think, but all the ways at the beginning that they tell him he's not right or that he loses roles had happened to him.
Oh, really?
And they say there's two stories about how the script got written. One is that it was, somebody wrote it and then it was adapted. And there were a lot of writers. I mean, this is one of those things where like six different writers worked on it, some uncredited. So one was Elaine May, who wrote Terry Garr's part and recommended her for it because she said she wrote it with her in mind. She fleshed out the women a lot. But one of them was, you mentioned MASH. Larry, is it Gelhart? Is that his name? Who was so good at writing for MASH and helped create the TV show. He was, he wrote a lot of the stuff in the script. Yeah, he's co-credited for the script. So Dustin Hoffman, when he was in Kramer versus Kramer, kind of had the idea that he said, well, now I'm having to see what it's like for a man to be a mother, right? Because... I don't know if you know that movie. Meryl Streep leaves him with their little boy, and he's never done all the mother stuff, but he has to now. That's part of the movie. That's most of the movie.
Yeah.
So at doing that movie, he said, I wonder what it would be like to actually, what kind of a woman would I be if I got the chance? And he started wanting to have the script written.
Really?
And it took years. And then... In fact, like Tootsie, that's the name of his mother's dog. When he wakes up, he has, as Tootsie, when we see him kind of waking up and getting ready to be Tootsie the first time, I didn't notice it, but the trivia says there's a picture of his mother on the bedside. And his mother, it was dedicated from him to his mother because she died before the movie came out. But anyway, so it's one of those things where it intersects with real life. And then when Sidney Pollack is talking about why nobody will work with Michael, the thing is Dabney Coleman, who plays the jerk director of the soap opera, was supposed to play that character. Well, Dustin Hoffman
mm-hmm.
and Sidney Pollack had so many fights that Dustin Hoffman went, you have to be the agent. You understand this part like no one. And he refused and refused and refused. And finally, as Dorothy Michaels, Dustin Hoffman started sending him notes and gifts and flowers and candy, begging him to do it.
Wow.
And he finally did it. So there's a lot of kind of real life experience that's leaking into a lot of this. And if you were watching at the time, you would have known a few of these things anyway.
Wow. How about that? Yeah.
At least to me, I remember from the beginning watching and just being delighted at how difficult he was, because I was like, wow, it shows he kind of has a sense of humor about himself.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, cool. Yeah. Had no clue. No clue. That's neat. That's really cool stuff.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but it's interesting how that came about, and that he kind of, you know, herded that script through a bunch of different writers, I guess, himself, Dustin Hoffman. Well,
yeah, and the other thing, too, that's kind of interesting is that, you know, in the movie, what we see is being Dorothy Michaels changes Michael Dorsey's – these names are going to get me every time – it changes his understanding of a lot of things about who he is, about how people are treated, about who they are. But the crew would only give bad news to Dustin Hoffman if he was dressed up as Dorothy. They said he was a lot nicer then.
Hmm. How about that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it is interesting that there was a scene, well, more than one scene, where he talks about, well, he's getting ready to be Dorothy and talking to someone, usually Jeff,
mm-hmm.
about what it's like to be her.
Yeah.
And how he wishes she was prettier.
Yeah.
Because she deserves it.
Mm-hmm.
And just the experience of being a woman. There's one scene in particular where Jeff walks in on her and I can't remember the actor's name, but he plays a doctor on the soap opera.
John, the actor.
Right. Where, you know, she's experiencing, you know, this guy is practically raping her.
Right.
And, or is getting ready to, and, you know, he's had a heck of a day full of things, like that.
Yeah.
And, But yeah, just having him talk about that was really interesting too. So you're right, you know, he's experiencing a lot of things, you know, and good things too. I say good things, you know, because he has a man who falls in love with her as well. It doesn't want to rape her, but wants to marry her.
It shows that Dorothy in herself as a person mm-hmm. has people who like her. I mean, you know, for whatever reason, she's worth something. And I think one of the things is a strength is you mentioned that scene about John Van Horn. That's his name.
Yeah, that's his name.
And
yeah.
He's pursuing her. But the comedy doesn't treat it like it doesn't just toss it off for a laugh. It could get crude or it could get, you know, just ignore it. But instead, what happens is Michael talks about almost being raped,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it's not dwelt on, but there are a couple lines where he goes, rape is no laughing matter. You know, he's like, this was happening.
Yeah.
And then they go on to something else, but they don't just go, oh, he really liked you and let it go. They make that point.
Yeah.
I know one of the mm-hmm. things they said about the movie was they told everybody to play it not as comic characters, but as dramatic characters caught in funny moments.
Interesting.
And I mm-hmm. think that's what adds to it, because it's not a farce. It is a real... It has sympathy for everybody in the movie, and you can only do that if you're not taking them lightly, you know?
Yeah, that's interesting. And it's a subtle difference, but it is a big difference, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I saw somewhere, it might have been on Wikipedia or something, where Dustin Hoffman, so it feeds right into what you're saying, but Dustin Hoffman said that he didn't consider it a comedy.
Right.
He never, there it is. Yeah, it's in Wikipedia. He concluded that he had never regarded Tootsie as a comedy.
Right.
That's fascinating. Yeah.
Well, and it in talking about the how it would affect people really anyway, he said that when he's in the movie and he's saying, I just wish you were a little prettier.
Mm.
I think it was the 20th anniversary of the movie. where he said that when he was being dressed up as Tootsie or Dorothy, he said he was like, oh, but can you, but make her prettier. And they're like, we're sorry, this is the best we can do. You can't be prettier. And he was really upset that he wasn't going to be a prettier woman. And then what he realized is that he had an epiphany that although he found Dorothy interesting, he wouldn't have talked to her at a party because she wasn't beautiful. And this is, I think, the first part of what you were reading. And as a result, he'd missed out on many conversations with interesting women.
Wow. And that's kind of in the movie, too. You know, because his character at a party, his birthday party, you know, every pretty woman he can find, he goes and talks to and tries to talk him into staying. But yeah, but that's something.
Well, his character is an interesting parallel with a lot of this, too, because for one thing, so as Dorothy Michaels, he can see how Julie, his love interest, well, he really likes her. She's not really a love interest, I guess, but in actuality. But he really has a crush on her. He really admires her so much. But she's in a very unhealthy relationship with a guy who's just using her. And he abhors this. He can't stand the guy. But then at the same time, as himself, as Michael, Terry Garr's character adores him, longs for him, is doing all the things, and he is ignoring her.
Yeah.
Because he only thinks of her as a friend, and he's not interested in her at all. And instead of being honest with her, he doesn't want to hurt her feelings. And so, oh, yeah, yeah, I'll be there. I'll be there. And it'll show her cooking dinner and shopping for things. And then he forgets all about the dinner. He's lying to her continually. So it's for a different reason than Julie's love interest, who is playing around with people. But it's equally dishonest.
Yeah, and there's a really telling scene where Dabney Coleman's character, who is in, you know, he's going out with, what's her name again? The actress.
Julie.
Is it Julie?
Yeah.
Okay, so he's going out with Julie. And uses almost the exact same sentences that Michael used earlier in the movie to tell Jeff about what was going on with the other, with Terry Garr.
Wow, I did not catch that.
Almost exactly the same, you know.
That is great.
You know, it was something, yeah.
I didn't catch that.
Yeah. So, yeah, and he was standing there as Dorothy, and he said something like, well, that's not right, you know, that's no way to treat a person or something like that.
Right.
But he knew that, you know, those are my words.
Did he register them?
See, I don't know.
I didn't catch that part.
I think he did. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So they're continually using very clever parallels and comparisons to bring up all their points because the movie is called Tootsie. And that, I think that word's only used once in the whole movie.
Yeah.
But it tells us exactly what the movie is about.
Yeah. You're right. You're right. That, I mean, that is a heck of a good title. But yeah, it's used once that I think it's just Toots, right? Doesn't the director call her Toots?
Oh, I thought it was Tootsie.
Maybe he did, but I thought it was Toots or something. But anyway,
yeah, and
he's
she
like,
goes, my name is Dorothy.
My name is Dorothy. Yep.
D-O-R-O-T-H-Y. Bill, John is always John and Bill is always Bill and so-and-so is always so-and-so.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, women are honey or sweetie or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, I have a name, use it. And he's like, oh.
Yeah. Yeah, and he's like, you know, women like me. Why don't you like me? And it bothered him that she didn't like him. You know, why not? He had to solve that one.
Well, and I like that that was the thing where I was thinking about the movie has sympathy for people, all the people. And I was like, well, maybe not him. And then I went, no, because we're shown he doesn't understand why this woman doesn't like him. And at the end, when Dustin Hoffman reveals that he's actually a man, he goes, that's it. Now, it doesn't mean you like him.
Right.
But you understand he's worried about this.
Right.
Why doesn't this work? It's part of his personality.
Yeah. And it was extremely important to him, on his mind constantly.
Yeah.
You know, why not? Why doesn't this work?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I liked what you had to say about Jessica Lange's character, too, because it is, you know, that kind of opens some stuff up. Because that's, you know, how she is treated by everyone, and also how she is living, you know, and mm-hmm. how she is in her personal life and all that stuff is a contrast to the way Tootsie is treated. Mm-hmm. But then Tootsie starts to become really famous, or I say Tootsie, Dorothy. Dorothy mm-hmm. starts to become really famous, sort of despite the fact that she's not attractive, right?
Right.
And I think that's interesting too. It's you know, and people really responded to her a lot in the movie, and that seemed true to life as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had somebody like this, and people are identifying with her on a different level. And yes. For Jessica Lange, you know, they're interfacing with her on basically a sexual level only. You know, there isn't this deep conversation or anything like that people are expecting from her mm-hmm. at all.
Well, no, yeah, it was interesting because you'd see her, you'd see how smart she was from the very beginning, Jessica Lange's character, Julie, where she'd kind of make little comments as she's maybe helping Dorothy pick up some paper she spilled and stuff like that. And that's what drew Dorothy's/Michael's attention to her, because he was so flustered already. He had no time to worry about who he was attracted to or who he wasn't, but it was her quick wit and her, you know, little sarcastic comments yeah. about things mm-hmm. that made him notice her.
Yeah. And then there were little moments where you started to understand how she was being treated. Like somebody asked the director, you know, do you need something? He says, yeah, bring me a coffee. And then he mm-hmm. says, do you need anything? And then he said, no, she doesn't need anything.
Right.
You know, and she's, you know, so she's kind of shoved to the side. And then Dorothy being a little more assertive, you know, she is sort of showing her how to be a little bit, right?
Right.
Yeah. And that's interesting too. You know, so it's like a man sort of showing a woman how to be more assertive, I guess. I'm not sure what thoughts I'm forming here, but mm-hmm. Jessica Lange's character grew knowing Dorothy, and watching Dorothy yeah. interact with people.
Yeah.
Changed her.
Well, and yeah, because Sandy, that's Terry Garr's character, and Julie are both too passive.
Mm-hmm.
And they both pick the wrong people continually and ignore all the signs that because they want something so badly, you know, they want, like Julie says, I just want to have somebody to have dinner with and this, so I'm compromising.
Mm.
But seeing Dorothy and the way she'll just stand up and not take stuff kind of awakens something in them. And I've seen people criticizing the movie for that, not many, but some people criticizing the movie, especially later, for that. But I think they forget what things were like in 1982. I think they forget people didn't really look at how many assumptions were made in a lot of places about women. And so the idea that you could be a strong woman is exemplified by the show's producer.
Yes, that's right.
You know,
mm-hmm.
But she's not ever shown as feminine or appealing. We don't see a lot of her. I mean, she's an interesting character. I like her a lot. But that's all you see. You don't see her interacting with everybody. She's a powerful figure, so she's kind of removed. So when Dorothy comes along, she's one of these people who can be in the midst of everybody. And because mm-hmm. she's not used to being treated like that, because she's really Michael, you know, who does it himself when he's being a man.
Yeah, yeah.
To Sandy. You know, you've got the double standard going in one person, which is what kind of makes it really interesting.
Yeah.
And also you kind of forget that they're doing this. They set it up like this on purpose. They're trying to show us this stuff on purpose. So, mm-hmm. of course, the women are going to be more passive. And because that's how it works a lot of the time, you know?
Yeah, yeah, sure.
You know?
I do, just, yeah.
Yeah, I also think that what people forget about, I'd watched it and I thought, oh, right, I forgot. Like, people bring up feminism a lot. And so this movie in 1982 was done at a time when a lot of people were dealing with women in general, going from being just wives and mothers to having a more active role in the workplace and society than they had in, say, the 60s or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And there's that transition period. And a lot of people they're doing it, but they're not quite sure of how to work with it necessarily. So people will bring up things like feminism. So when Les, who's Julie's father, who's interested in Dorothy, is talking, he's like, oh, well, you know, my wife was the greatest and I don't understand this feminism stuff much. A man's a man or a woman's a woman. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, right. People don't talk like that anymore because that's kind of accepted now.
Yeah, that's right.
That was more of a newer thing that people were grappling with. And then you see the gender confusion a la the 1980s. So when Julie thinks, when Michael forgets himself and he's dressed as Dorothy and there's that moment and he's kind of leaning in a little for a kiss and Julie suddenly realizes, oh my gosh, I think Dorothy's a lesbian.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, oh no, you don't understand. And Julie goes, no, it's me. I'm just not well adjusted enough. I'm sure I've got the same impulses. I mean, obviously I did have the same impulses. Because she was kind of leaning into it. She's like, no, I haven't embraced, you know, my sexuality or whatever. And then you also have Sandy, who at a different point, when she's so enraged by Michael, and she's like, I've read The Second Sex. I know I'm responsible for my own orgasm. It's just like, it's all the party line of what you're supposed to have done.
Right,
you
right.
know, as a feminist woman. So it's just funny to hear that stuff trotted out because people don't think about that stuff now.
Yeah, that's really true. That's really true. Yeah, and I thought a couple of times during the movie, you know, how different, like I said earlier, how different it would have been had it been made today.
Mm-hmm.
Because I guess, I don't know, the lines weren't so clearly drawn or mm-hmm. you know, the lines were more clearly drawn back then. The roles were more specifically, you know, drawn out mm-hmm. than they are today, and now I don't know, to have a man dressed as a woman wouldn't be a real big shock to anybody, probably.
Yeah. I think it would still be more of a shock than most people would recognize, but they'd all know we're supposed to accept it and we'll move on.
Right that's true.
I think and that's one of the things I was thinking. This movie is so funny because it's a lot of stuff that we know is still true today. You know, women aren't necessarily going to, you're going to be yourself, of course, but you may express it very differently than a man. That's okay. And that's something that I think both feminists back then and feminists now kind of tend to forget. It's that idea that to be equal, you have to be the same. You know, like women should be just like a man and do better than a man to be really representing the sex well. Instead of looking at, we have a lot of complementary qualities that aren't the same. Mm-hmm. And it's okay because you can still express yourself fully in that way. And that's kind of, that's what Tootsie shows us. If I'm
cool. No,
expressing
no,
I, that well.
That's great. Yeah. Yeah. But I've always thought that, but you know, then I'm a man, you know? So it's like, you know, in today's society, it's hard for, to speak up about any of this kind of stuff because, you know, if I'm complimentary, it's like, you know, well, why are you, you know, you're a man, you know? So, you don't know what you're talking about. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
I'm in that position a lot of time in society. You know, I can't comment on a lot of social things because I am the one who is irrelevant. You know what
yes,
I'm saying?
At the bottom.
Because I've been at the, I'm at the top and therefore I'm at the bottom. If that makes any sense, mm-hmm. that's the way I think it's been explained to me. But it's obvious when you look at it. And it's obvious, you know, women are different from men. I know that some of it is societal, right? But mm-hmm. but fundamentally, there's some fundamental differences there, right?
Mm-hmm.
And God created man and woman, and all that stuff. But the you know, you guys can do a lot of things that we can't do, and that's just a fact. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
So it's always been interesting to me that the goal of feminism seems to be to be like men. And, you know, so it's like, okay, well, we need to do everything that, that the men do, and that's what we want to do. But the fact is that women are already doing a heck of a lot of things that men can't do. So what they're really saying is we want to do everything that men do and everything that women do. Or we want all the choices of those things. And right. I feel like I'm getting in dangerous territory here, but it's like, it's like there's no celebration of or appreciation of what women do that men can't. It's like it's almost a shoving aside of that in favor of what men are like.
Well, and also there are a lot of qualities that men have that I don't want to have. I'm perfectly happy having my husband be the complimentary part, that I don't want to do or be all the things that he is. That's why we work well together as a team, as a married couple, you know?
Yeah.
In fact, we were just talking the other day about, since we just helped put on the, gosh, I think we've been doing it for 10 years at the semi-annual wedding or marriage retreat at our parish, right? And so we were in a reflective mood, and I'm saying, you know, how I was so grateful over all our years of marriage that he has – just being around him has helped make me a different and a better person. And it's not that I've become more like him, but he's got some really great qualities that have been examples to me as I watch him live life with me. Mm. And he, of course, then really shocked me by going, well, you've done the same thing for me. And so we started talking about it and going, oh, right. Well, some of the things that me as a feminine person express in various ways, even though I have a super strong personality, and him as a man, he's got a gentler personality, but equally determined underneath his, you know, laid backness, we have influenced each other in ways that are actually me feminine and him appreciating it, and him masculine and me appreciating it. And there's nothing wrong with that. And these days, you know, I thought we kind of had gotten over a lot of that. You have to be just the same. You have to be equal to be, you know, exactly the same as somebody to be equal. I thought we'd gotten over that after the 70s. And here we are again. And I guess it's because everything else to do with gender is being thrown up in the air while everybody looks at it like this movie kind of. But I find it tiring. I find it kind of, and here I go, I find it kind of stupid. You know, it's a lack of nuance in looking at how people are with each other. Because one of the things this movie does is it looks at all of them as individuals, as well as being men and women. Because one of the things you see is Julie and Sandy, who's Terry Garr, they're both too passive. They're both picking the wrong man. They're both actresses, but they also are different. Julie's not completely passive. She's raising a child that she had by herself. She's working a very demanding job. She's innocent, but she's not unaware. And when she sees a better way, she works to improve herself. She goes out and breaks off with that awful boyfriend. You know, Terry Garr, she does her speech about, you know, oh, yeah, which one of my favorite lines is, you know, she says, tell me the truth, Michael, tell me the truth. I don't know. Yeah, just tell me. I can take anything, but just tell me the truth. So he tells her, well, I'm interested in another woman. And she screams and he goes, well, you said you wanted the truth. She goes, well, I didn't say how I'd feel about it, did I?
Yeah.
Like, oh. But then what she does is she does, that's when she does her speech about, I've read The Second Sex. Mm-hmm. But at the end, she takes the candy that was meant for somebody else.
Yeah.
She doesn't have that pride of person. She's still desperate. Now, of course, for money and everything else, and she needs food and all this, but she's still not standing up for herself.
Yeah. Interesting.
And that's the thing I think, I don't understand. I think everybody thinks that to be a modern woman, you've got to be like that producer on the TV show who we're not shown of, or on the soap opera who we're not shown much of.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, equal pay and all that stuff. I'm completely for. Yeah. You know, if you're doing that, that's not what I'm saying.
Women's basketball. Yeah. That's great.
Right, right. So it's just a very confusing time for people like me, I guess. We're trying to understand what the heck is going on. But I have to say that a lot of the gender fluidity stuff that's kind of flying around, I simply just don't understand it.
No,
I simply don't. And you know, when you read books, you know, especially, I mean, so much of the science fiction that's being written today has to do with that. You know, it's like sort of the main point is, you know, I read one of those and I'm just like completely not connecting at all with it. And I just don't get it at all. So, but you know, when you watch something like Tootsie, where things are clearly defined and it's kind of showing you, you know, how different people are, mm-hmm. and that should be okay. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, this kind of feeds into, it's kind of a larger, and you use the word, it's a larger subject, you know, of equality. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, equality, in my opinion, is a myth. You can't have equality.
Right.
So what I'm saying is, I am never going to be equal to you, right? I am me and you are right. You. And we have different talents, we have different interests, we have different everything, right? And so there's never going to be an equality between us, but that doesn't make any difference. It's that's not a goal, you know? Your goal isn't right. to be me, and my goal is not to be you.
Right.
But that seems to be where a lot of this stuff stems from in my head. Is this concept of equality that is actually an unhealthy concept to begin with?
Well, it makes me think of, I think it was C.S. Lewis who said he didn't like to think that he was the same as everybody else. He goes, 'cause that kind of drags us all down to the same level. He goes, but what I like to think is everyone else is as unique as I am.
Right. And that's
because that raises right. us all up to appreciate all the things that we all are. And that's what I think these attempts to legislate and institutionalize equality, some of that has to be there, because otherwise you don't have, you know, fair pay. You don't have people working under same working conditions and all these various things. So we're not talking about that. We're talking about just kind of a general attitude in society towards people. And yeah, and on those things, it really, that comes to me a lot. Like when I'm at Mass watching everybody go up there, and I think each one of these people is as unique as I am. Mm-hmm. I cannot tell it from looking at them from the outside. This person just looks old and feeble. This person is a baby. This person is, you know, a young mother who is overweight and her clothes aren't great or whatever. But inside, they're each as unique as I am. And that is the, if you would use the word equality, that is the value of each person is just the same to God and therefore should be just the same to me.
Yeah.
And that in a way is loving your neighbor as yourself.
Yeah. That's so well put, you know, so we're equal in the eyes of God, right?
Right.
That's the only possible place for equality to actually right. occur. So, you know, as you were saying that, it seems to me that equality has sort of, you know, spilled over, right? So what you're talking about, you know, equal pay and all that kind of stuff, absolutely, we believe in that, or I believe in that. That's not what we're saying at all, but it's almost like that concept of equality, we need to make sure that people have chances, you know, equal opportunities, right?
Right.
We need to make sure that that's true. But that right. has now spilled over as a philosophy into actual equality, right? Which is an impossibility. It's a philosophical impossibility.
Right.
It's right. the same thing that happened with relativity, right? So Einstein comes up with relativity, and he's saying, you know, hey, you know, basically what he's saying is, it depends. Some of these physical things that are happening in the universe depend on your perspective, right? If you're mm-hmm. if you're here and you're cruising along at 1,000 miles an hour, you know, relatively something else is moving relative to you at a different speed or whatever, and then that became you know, all these ideas about the speed of light and time and all these things, because everything just kind of became relative to your frame of reference. Well, then that becomes a philosophy, right?
Right.
There was a book by Paul Johnson about the 20th century, and he was listing a couple of things that he thought were the things that the 20th century gave us that are really going to be difficult to overcome.
One of them
was relativity, but it's not Einstein's relativity. It's the philosophy that came out of that and made people
think.
Yeah, relativism, exactly. So this relativity became philosophically, truth is relative.
Right.
And it's not. There's that, you know, a guy that I like to listen to, his name is Rabbi Zacharias. I've talked about it here. You know, when he talks about this, he's like, you know, even in India, it's me or the bus when I walk out into the street. It's not both, you know,
yes.
and there's all, that's not what both means, you know, when you're talking about a both and philosophy, that is not what it means. You're not denying the reality of it's this or that, you know?
Right.
But it's become that philosophy. Now, the other thing that he mentioned, Paul Johnson in that book, it was called Modern Times, just came to my head.
Okay, I was wondering.
Yeah, he said that Sigmund Freud was the other one.
Yeah.
And for him, I think the way he phrased it was, the idea of being sick instead of sinful
is
something that is going to be difficult to overcome. Because, you know, if you're not responsible for your actions anymore, because you are biologically... My genes made me do it, which is the current theme, you know, my genes, I have genes that tell me that I'm going to be like this, and therefore I'm not really responsible. That idea is the other thing that he said is dangerous.
Well, and both those things seem to strip us of, well, not maybe relativism, but certainly that idea of my genes made me do it strips our free will away from us.
Right.
It's an excuse, but it's an excuse also not to do better.
Yeah, so it's like it's an excuse not to do better, and then relativity is an excuse to not make a decision.
Yeah.
Right, so it's like...
You want, really.
Yeah, exactly. So that's why relativism is difficult, because you can never, as a society, agree... Well, you can never agree between two people on what is right and what is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, this guy wants to have his friends over for dinner and this guy wants to eat his friends for dinner. Well, how can you tell me that that was wrong if there is no truth? Right.
Yeah.
And because that's a lot, there are some steps between truth is relative and there. So I took a big leap to there. But the thing is, the steps are very clear that when you get to there, you can't hardly have an argument about morality at all.
Well, it sounds like something that Peter Kreeft says sometimes, and he'll be teaching a class on philosophy and he'll start off talking about, can we know what's true or not true and what's right and what's wrong? And everybody says, oh yeah, you really can't know and all this. So everybody gets to the point where they agree on this. They all argue themselves right into that.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, okay, so I've really decided how this class is going to work. Everybody on this side of the room is getting a B and everyone on that side of the room is getting an A. And so, and this huge uproar breaks out. That's not fair. And he's like, well, now hold on a minute. Mm-hmm. Do you mean there's a truth here that is universal to everybody? And they all go, oh crap. There are some things that we all agree on.
That's right. That's right.
And I would say that idea of sinfulness, that's interesting that you brought that up, because it made me think about, it connected for me with a point that I had made a note about, which is, you know, one of the things people complaining about is Michael being portrayed as the savior of womankind, right? Because he's a man. But what stops that from being really valid, the movie itself addresses that, because as a man, he's pretty much so difficult and such a loser in a lot of ways. And so he's only that better person when he's improvising as Dorothy. So he also is learning diplomacy, how to express himself in other ways, how to adopt the approach a woman takes, which is, you know, he says at one point, I can't remember who he's talking to, Jeff maybe. And he goes, oh, well, I let him explain, then I do what I want. Okay. Well, and those are all kind of seen as being weak. But when he does it, it's seen as being strong because he's forced into corners where he has to be more forceful because he doesn't want John Van Horn to kiss him because, he, you know, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so.
That's thinking, an excellent point.
Yeah. And so he's learning from the role. And so what that made me think of is when we play roles, sometimes they teach us also.
Agreed.
So and, we try to be better people. We pretend, you know, and in a sense, we're pretending to be better. We're trying to put on Christ. And sometimes Christ will work through us and we're surprised at ourselves. And sometimes it's that moment when you're like, I don't want to be nice. And you realize, or at least I do, crap. That's the moment when you have to be nice. It's not about when you just feel like it. And that's when you're playing that role, being that better person. And you get through the other side and you go, wow, it worked. I'm proud of myself. I did it. I can do it again.
Yeah. So,
you know,
yeah, it's the concept that we're changeable as well. You know, if you feel trapped in a certain pattern of behavior, you know, at the end of the movie, Michael says, I just need to learn how to do this as a man when he's talking to Julie.
Yeah. He was a better man as a woman when he was with her than he was as a man.
Right. Right. And he's like, I just need to learn how to do that as a man now.
Without the dress.
Exactly. Yeah. Without the dress. Right. So, but the sort of uplifting point there for me is that you are not set in your ways.
Right.
You know, so it's like you can do this. You can be different. If you have a problem with something that you're doing and you know that it's holding you back and you know that it's hurting people and things, you can be different.
Yeah.
It's not the fact that your genes are telling you to do this, right? It's like, you know, you can be a different person. You can be different. You can adjust yourself.
Well, that's, yeah. And that's part of what we see Julie learning to stand up for herself. And then she ultimately does it at the end when she punches him in the stomach.
Mm-hmm.
She's so mad. She would never have done that before. And it's not that that's necessarily the right thing to do, but she's definitely expressing herself and she's definitely cut him off and giving him the cold shoulder. And he's having to step up and explain himself.
Mm.
And she's not being passive with him.
Right.
You know, things are going to go forward on her terms. Now, they're very gentle, mild terms, but it is a comedy. So, you know, we're not going to get a screed here, which is the refreshing part.
Yeah.
And I think that's what a modern movie might do. If it depends on the director, of course, but modern movies tend to like to lecture us.
Yeah. And you know what? I mean, that's an excellent point, too, because I never felt lectured to in this movie. It was not a lecture.
It was funny.
And because it felt true, that's what made it so great. It rang true. It rang true. So,
right.
Yeah. Didn't need to be lectury.
Yeah. We got the point.
Mm-hmm.
That's why when I first read people, you know, like I say, from like the 20 or 25th anniversary, people going, oh, he's the savior of womankind. I went, what? That never occurred to me because that's not the vibe you get at all. And I was like, oh, these are hardcore feminist type women only looking at it with that lens.
Yeah. Yeah.
To me.
And that's another good point. You know, what lens are we looking at the world through all the time? You know, we can see so many things and so many different things. So my lens for today's society is a very confused rainbow lens. Nothing is ever clear to me at all.
I was just thinking about that today. I was taking a walk and I was thinking about transgender people and thinking, because I cannot actually fathom. I understand what they're telling me. I'm not saying that they don't feel this way. I'm just like, I cannot grasp it with my regular traditional brain. Right. Mm. So, as for some reason it occurred to me and I was thinking, well, and there's like, well, I've always felt like a woman, say if you're a man. And I'm like, well, how do you know what that feels like? Isn't that just you? I don't understand. you know, and I just was like, well, clearly I just don't understand. Hmm. Maybe I would always think I'm a man because I'm a more forceful personality. I don't know, but I just am me.
Yeah.
And here I am.
Right.
Anyway.
Yeah. What can you say? I don't know.
Yeah. I can't say anything. I just don't understand these things. And so I just try to be respectful and remember they're as unique as me and not extra unique from me. They're just unique in their own way.
Yeah, as are all people, right? You know, that's what you said. That's what you said earlier. Yeah,
is that way.
Yeah,
we're all equal in that way. I insist on saying that we're all equally unique,
mm-hmm.
and that's what kind of helps me with all that stuff that I'm confused about.
Yeah, that's right. That's a good point as well. Lots of good points.
Did you have a favorite part of the movie?
Oh boy, let's see. The parts with Jeff just made me laugh. You know, they're off the main track, but I enjoyed him immensely. Mm-hmm. Like, at the party, he's talking about, I want people to come in out of the rain. And, you know, so I want to do theater where people are wet, you know, because they're alive right then.
Right.
And I want to only have shows when it rains, you know, that kind of stuff is just so absurd. It just made me laugh. And that he probably ad-libbed that is even better.
Yeah.
But I enjoyed him a lot, you know, when he says, don't play hard to get.
with some of, oh. Tell me you're not doing this for the outputs.
Oh my gosh. I just love that guy. Yeah. So he makes me laugh. No end. And that part with Terry Garr, mm-hmm. that you mentioned earlier where she screamed mm-hmm. after he told her, she's just tell me, I laughed out loud so hard this time. It was a total shock. And I love her anyway. I think she's great.
She is so great. I really love her. And one of the parts that struck me is, you know, I've told you a lot of the funny parts already I liked, but one of the parts that struck me was the part where Michael has been playing, you know, Dorothy Michaels on the soap opera, and Sandy was hoping to get that part, right? So she's eaten up with jealousy over the whole thing. So all she's doing is bad-mouthing that actress. Well, Michael's taking her seriously. Instead of recognizing that she's just jealous and upset, and so she's just blowing off steam and criticizing everything she can think of, he's like, what, do you think so? I didn't think so. I thought people said she was pretty good like that. No, anyone could tell this. Oh, and he's really hit in a vulnerable spot because that's him, but he can't tell anyone.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was a moment where he was kind of having to take it on the chin in a way that he wouldn't usually. Usually he would have fought back.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because I have to say, one of my funny spots that is from the very beginning where it's showing him trying out or losing parts or quitting or whatever. And it's like he's having his dying scene and everything looks like it's going great. And the director says, okay, now right after this bit of the speech, you have to stand up and move over to that side of the porch. And he's like, he's dying. He's just said this. Why does he have to move? Because the left side of the house can't see you, darling.
You know? Oh, man.
It was like the stupidest things. And that's when he quits, you know, because that wouldn't work.
That's not how, that's not while I'm playing this part.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, too funny. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Just excellent. Mm-hmm. Just excellent. Good choice.
Oh, I'm glad you liked it.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, that was something.
I hadn't seen it in so long.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to see it again.
That's good. Well, cool.
And I knew it had a lot of, you know, gender things in it of some sort.
Right.
So,
yeah, but it is an interesting time. It's going to be, you know, where are we headed? That's going to be really interesting to see what things are like in 20 years.
Well, I have to say something too, is back to this podcast, that I thought this was a wonderful image. The what's it called again? Jaws of Life podcast, where they start off and they're like, okay, so you see I'm not a guy, so I don't remember what car they said, a Ferrari or a Maserati going down the highway. It's very sleek. It's very, everybody wants it. And they're like, but us, nope. We're in the Winnebago RV. It's kind of beat up. It's clattering along. It's pretty comfortable. Oh, everybody can fit inside.
That's
They've got everything you need in here. That's the church. And I was like, because I think of the church as this beautiful, glorious thing mm-hmm. that everybody should want to be in. And I'm like, but I think you're right. It's the Winnebago, that it's got space for everyone and you can fix dinner in it and you can sleep in it. And it might not always be the most comfortable, but there's room for everybody you need in there. And it's like,
oh, that's awesome.
Yep.
That's hilarious. You make me laugh because I have been driving a minivan since like 2003.
Really?
Yeah. And that's my personal vehicle. It's, you know, my wife has a different car.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it just makes me laugh. So I am the opposite of someone who wants a Ferrari. I'm all for utility.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. We can get everybody in this, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
And I use it all the time. It's like, you know, at work, you know, if we're going to lunch, everybody piles in my van, you know?
Right.
So, but you're right. That's such a cool image. The RV. Mm-hmm. Everybody fits in this. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
They even get laughed at by my son, even, who's like, you know, you should get something else. You should go ahead and get this. I'm like, no, this is perfect. What are you talking about? Best car I've ever had.
Yeah. When this breaks, how am I going to find another one?
That's right. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
Well, here we are in our Winnebago RV.
That's right. So well done, Jaws of Life.
Exactly. Doesn't turn quickly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, has to take a few 5-point turns to get somewhere.
Oh, I love that image. It's like a little forward, a little back. A little forward, a little back. A little forward as you're trying to turn around.
And it's not going to ever be this thing. That's not happening.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, that makes me laugh so hard. That's so perfect. Oh,
I know.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, we'll have to we'll send them a link after we do this.
Oh, I can't wait to hear it. It's written down.
Yeah, so. Anyway.
Subscribing. Wonderful. All right. So where are we headed next? Let's see. I've got to call it up because it's not up. Yes, The Inklings by Humphrey Carpenter, which is a nonfiction book about Tolkien and Lewis and Williams and all the folks who used to hang out together in the pub.
Yep.
So yeah, I can't wait to reread that. That's one I've felt like rereading for a while. So. I'm gonna get right on that.
I just finished it and it's quite good.
Good, good, good.
Enjoyed it a lot. I'm even glad knowing you did. A lot mm-hmm. about the Inklings, I still enjoyed it quite a bit. So
wonderful. Wonderful. Yeah. All right. Well, good. So thank you very much for this movie.
Oh, you're very welcome. I'm glad you liked it.
And thanks
everybody
for listening.
Everybody go watch it 2 or 3 times.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And thanks for listening, everybody.
Yes, we'll talk to you in a couple weeks.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.